Hello and welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the growing concern on Wall Street that the Republican House will default on the debt of the United States for the first time in the nation's history, and discuss the consequences for the global financial markets, the U.S. and the world's economies, with former banker, now financial reporter William Cohan, a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and the author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. Then, with the passing of the 12th year mark of the U.S. and NATO war in Afghanistan, we will discuss this broken country at a time when our government is broken, with former Marine and State Department official Matthew Ho, who in 2009 resigned in protest over U.S. strategic policy and goals in Afghanistan, with President Karzai blaming NATO for not securing his nation and bringing great suffering, and with Karzai's brother, a pedophile, a warlord, and the mentor of the 9/11 mastermind running to succeed Karzai, we will look into Afghanistan's uncertain future. Then finally, with Tuesday's arrival of the much-delayed new $100 bill, we will discuss why the world's favorite currency, two-thirds of which circulates abroad and is continually counterfeited, has been so long in coming, and whether the new bill that uses long-available technology, making it harder to counterfeit, will save the Treasury the billions lost every year to counterfeiters. Dr. Benjamin Mazzota, a researcher at the Center for Emerging Market Enterprises at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University, joins us to shatter the myth that cash is free of cost. And joining us now is William Cohan, the author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. William Cohan is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and writes for the New York Times, where he covers a variety of financial issues. His acclaimed book, House of Cards, A Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, details the last days of Bear Stearns and Company, and he began his career as an investigative reporter in Raleigh, North Carolina, and then went on to work on Wall Street for over a decade and a half, both at Lazard Frere and J.P. Morgan Chase. In 2007, he published The Last Tycoon, The Secret History of Lazard Frere and Company. Welcome to Background Briefing, William Cohan.
Thank you, Ian. Great to be here.
And there seems to be as much as there's a concern, particularly in Washington, that the Republican House is determined to go to the wall and over the cliff with and default on the U.S. debt. There seems to be a certain amount of complacency on Wall Street, where a number of senior strategists are basically saying there's zero chance. So let's start with that sense of complacency in the face of, we've already had the Black Swan incident with Lehman Brothers. Why do you think people don't think the Republicans are crazy enough to do what they say they're determined to do?
Well, I'm not exactly sure why there are people who are crazy enough to think that the Republicans won't do what they're threatening to do, because they've sort of done it before. They've brought us to the brink. Last time this occurred, there was a negotiation and there was a compromise. But, you know, we had the fiscal cliff, we had the sequester, so there was no blinking that time. So, I guess maybe this is the way they can potentially make their mark if they turned out to be right. But I'm afraid we've got, people in government, the Republicans, who would be, believe it or not, seem to be happy if we default on our debt. And it's obviously rattling the market. So I'm not sure where these strategists are get their confidence from.
But you can excuse the Tea Party for economic illiteracy and their followers and the Republicans. I was watching the Senate debate today. John Cornyn, former judge up there with the mantra that this is all about a shock therapy in order to get us to deal with the deficits. Now, we all know that the deficits are going down at record speed. That doesn't even make any sense. So you can excuse politicians and their constituents for being economically illiterate, but you cannot excuse Wall Street bankers for being economically illiterate, surely.
Well, I completely agree with you. I'm not even sure. I mean, I cannot excuse Wall Street bankers for being economically illiterate. And again, maybe these strategists are just, wishing and hoping that this won't happen. And let's just hope that they're right. But, I mean, unfortunately, I think we've got the pin on the hand grenade has been pulled. The question is, are they going to throw it in the direction of the Capitol or not, or the Treasury? And I also, frankly, at this point, don't excuse Tea Party Republicans for not understanding economics, for not understanding. I mean, their leaders certainly do. I mean, Ron Paul, who's not in Congress anymore, wrote a book about the Fed. His son obviously must have gotten something by osmosis, if no, nothing else. They have to understand the dynamics and the importance of not allowing the U.S. government to default on its debt. I mean, it's one of our great assets in this country is the fact that we are a fiat currency. We are a currency that other nations like to trade with, the dollar, and we are generally seen, although this is unfortunately quickly evaporating, and I never thought this would be possible, we are seeing, you know, we are have long enjoyed the benefit of people wanting to invest in our country and keeping our interest rates low and our and capital, you know, swimming around our whole economy, which has been to the great benefit of everyone.
So this would be the ultimate in shooting oneself in the foot or financial suicide. And Bloomberg Businessweek have reported today that failure by the world's largest borrower to pay its debt, unprecedented in modern history, will devastate stock markets from Brazil to Zurich, halt a $5 trillion lending mechanism for investors who rely on treasuries, blow up borrowing costs for billions of people and compromise and people and companies, and ravish the dollar and throw the U.S. and world economies into a recession that probably would become a depression.
And you know, maybe, I mean, I don't disagree with Bloomberg Businessweek's assessment, and maybe that is why these Wall Street strategists are claiming that there's quote-unquote zero probability of this happening, because it just seems so dystopian that even the Tea Party Republicans, who seem to wear only dystopian glasses, would actually allow this to happen. And so maybe, you know, something good can possibly come out of this if we can avoid the default, where, you know, you would reopen the government, have an agreement on the debt limit, and have an agreement, you know, some sort of grand bargain, which, again, you will remember, maybe a year plus ago, we were all talking about the possibility of a grand bargain that never happened, which is, I agree, is overdue and is needed to happen. We do have to get budget deficits in order, but, you know, to have a, you know, sort of a scorched earth policy, which is what these Tea Party Republicans are embracing, makes absolutely no sense.
Again, I'm speaking with William Cohen, the author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. William Cohen is a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and writes for the New York Times, where he covers a variety of financial issues. And the $12 trillion of outstanding government debt is 23 times the $517 billion that Lehman Brothers owed when they tanked back in September of 2008. So that gives you an idea of the scale of what where the Tea Party Republicans are playing with here. Warren Buffett says it would be like a nuclear bomb, basically too horrible to use. I mean, he's I guess he's saying it should be, but, you know, this I don't know whether you can apply mutually assured destruction to Wall Street, but
to our own. You know, there's nobody doing. We're doing this to ourselves.
Exactly right.
That's the scary thing. I mean, right. What we're talking about doing it to ourselves. I mean, they certainly got our attention. You know, they've strapped explosive devices to their body. They're probably like a suicide bomber, and they're threatening to, you know, blow up the U.S. economy. And frankly, since we're a leader of the world economy, threatening to derail all of the progress that has been made in the last 5 years, and it's considerable progress, and it was not easy to accomplish. I mean, you know, Europe is still very fragile, and this obviously will have repercussions across the globe. And it just is, it's almost inconceivable that they would actually go through with it. And again, maybe that is what Wall Street strategists are counting on. But, you know, we all know that they're just crazy enough to do it, even though it makes no sense whatsoever.
And a couple of the strategists who've come out with this complacency are Adam Parker, chief U.S. equity strategist at Morgan Stanley. He puts the chances of a default at 0%. Joseph Lavogna, chief U.S. economist at Deutsche Bank, says it's effectively zero. But there's Gina Adams, a senior analyst at Wells Fargo Securities, and she's apparently Wall Street's most bearish strategist. She says market indicators suggest a high level of complacency despite the policy risks. So she's straddling a bit there, you know. So So where would you stand? I mean, if you're advising people what to do, I mean, what could people do, frankly? I mean, how do you avoid? I mean, you're on the Titanic, you can see the iceberg, and you're on the bridge, and you're basically saying to the captain, you know, steer to the left or right, but don't hit it.
It's incredible that we've gotten ourselves into this position again. Maybe when history books are written, we will see things like the fiscal cliff, the sequester, the sequestration, all of these threats, the Tea Party, you know, itself, which, you know, frankly, rose out of the whole financial crisis when I guess it was Rick Santelli on CNBC encouraged people to, you know, throw tea into the ocean again instead, you know, and not pay their mortgages. It's really extraordinary to me that this is almost childlike. I mean, you know, this is the kind of tantrum you would expect, you know, a 5-year-old to engage in, and why they think that this kind of tantrum will work. I actually think President Obama has been correct in not negotiating with these, effectively, these economic terrorists. And it's incredible that they're doing it to our own country. They're doing it to themselves. They're doing it to their own constituencies because, you know, as gerrymandered as these Republican districts have become, and probably as safe as they think their districts are, the people who work in these districts are going to be affected by this. You know, if the economy goes off the cliff again, you know, any progress that we've made in the last, you know, 3 or 4 years, which is not enough for Main Street. Wall Street has obviously done much better than Main Street in the last 5 years. But that minor progress that has been made, which is not sufficient by anybody's reckoning, is destined to be completely lost if this happens.
Well, William Cohen, already though, the Republicans have done tremendous damage to the President of the United States. It's obvious that their hatred for him is irrational, and a lot of people think it's based in racism, because so much of the traction for the Tea Party is in the South and in the former Confederacy. And you can't, I mean, let's look, for example, at what just the summit that just took place in Bali, Indonesia, of the Asia and the Asian countries. You know, Obama's much touted pivot to Asia. Well, what happens when the President of the United States doesn't even show up with his pivot to Asia? He has to say, "I'm sorry, I can't come." And everybody, you know, the Chinese are all muttering to themselves, "My God, this guy can't even keep his own government under control. Why should we deal with him?" This is the damage that they're doing. I know they hate this guy, but do they understand that they're not just damaging Obama, they're damaging the United States?
Well, that's the part that, Ian, that they seem to be missing, because once again, like in the Syria situation, where they gave, these Tea Party Republicans gave an opening to Putin, and actually it was probably the kind of solution, diplomatic solution, that everybody breathed a sigh of relief about. But once again, I mean, Putin was, you know, muttering at this conference, the ASEAN conference, you know, where he's sort of making fun, in fact, of Obama for not being there and saying things like, he doesn't blame the president. If he had that kind of government, you know, difficulty in Russia, he probably would not have gone either. Implying, by the way, that something is wrong with democracy, where the President of the United States can't even attend a conference for fear that his government will be shut down or is shut down and can't open it back up again. You know, it makes a mockery of democracy around the world. That's the problem. And you have the Chinese and the Russians dining out on that.
So, William Cohen, last time we had this fiscal cliff situation where the full faith and credit of the United States was threatened, and Obama did negotiate, and it's led to the sequester. And at least this time around, he laid down a marker that he wasn't going to negotiate. And it's unlikely that he – I mean, most people don't think he should fold. And obviously, they're counting on him folding. But last time around, he said that he wouldn't use the 14th Amendment just to get rid of this whole idea of a debt ceiling as a device to get around it. But his White House National Economic Council Director, Gene Sperling, has not ruled out a short-term interest to the borrowing cap, such as, you know, a few weeks or so. Is that a realistic stopgap measure?
Well, again, you know, the issue is you don't default on the debt until you don't pay the interest when it's due. You know, there are many expenses that the government has. There are, payroll for employees. There's combat troops. And there's interest on the debt. And so you don't default on that interest on the debt until you don't pay it. So there are ways, just like the Secretary of Defense called back 400,000 furloughed workers to Defense Department to come to work this morning. There, you know, I'm sure we're going to see interesting rulings coming out of general counsels in the White House counsel's office that might permit either the president to invoke the 14th Amendment, as he said he wouldn't do, but might find that he has no choice but to do, just like the Secretary of Defense was able to call back 400,000 furloughed Defense Department workers, even though the government is shut down. So I think this is a moment where we're going to have to be sort of legally creative and put an end to this lunacy, because the United States simply cannot default on their debt, especially when we're not insolvent. It's one thing if, you know, we're insolvent, as Russia was, I mean, when they defaulted on their debt, but we are not insolvent. This is all a self-inflicted wound, and it makes a mockery of our country and our standing in the world, and it's really a tragic shame.
Well, but I think, hasn't Treasury run out of options in terms of shuffling things around and playing games with the debt ceiling? I mean, in other words, isn't it crunch time, October the 17th?
Well, I mean, again, that's when they say approximately they will run out of proceeds. You know, when the revenue that comes in, then they won't be able to pay our debts as interest payments as they become due. But, you know, there are other ways, of course. I mean, you could continue to cut expenses. It's not only, I mean, just because you've reached the limit on your credit card, you could possibly, you know, not make other payments to pay down your credit card. There are ways to do it. I'm no OMB expert, but there's an awful lot of cash, you know, sloshing around through the system. And I'm sure they're looking at all of these ways to avoid not paying interest on the debt. Because if you don't pay the interest on the debt, then you know, people are going to lose faith, and the cost of our borrowing is going to get much higher if and when we choose to be able, we are able to borrow again. And that's going to, you know, the interest payments on the debt are one of the biggest parts of our budget deficit. So that will, you know, the cost of, which has been effectively very low because of the Fed's quantitative easing programs. If they don't make the payment on the debt, our interest costs are going to spike, and that's going to make our budget, it's going to be a death spiral down. It's just going to get worse and worse, making those looming budget deficits even more important than ever before to bring down.
But we know from the last time around that the U.S.'s credit rating was downgraded by Standard & Poor's. And in fact, the Chinese, who are the biggest foreign holders of U.S. treasuries, have urged Washington to do something to avoid a crisis. And they've referred, this is quoting their finance minister, saying, "We hope the United States fully understands the lessons of history," referring to the downgrading of the U.S. credit rating by Standard & Poor's in 2011. So, I mean, it's embarrassing.
Well, not only is it embarrassing, it's just going to cost us a lot more to finance our deficits, because, you know, the Chinese have been very charitable, frankly, in buying our treasury securities at low rates of interest to help us finance these huge deficits. And then part of the reason they do that is because they have liked the safety and security of the U.S. economy. You know, it has been one of the strongest performing economies, historically for a very long time. And this kind of bad behavior jeopardizes that and makes people question, you know, our collective sanity as a nation and our collective sanity of democracy. Well, you know, we all know that it's better than any other form of government, and we wouldn't trade it for anything else. But unfortunately, when a small minority of Tea Party radicals can hold us hostage and force us into potentially defaulting on our debt, then we really have to scratch our heads and wonder what's going on.
And their rationalization expressed today on the Senate floor by Senator Cornyn and others is that we're really concerned about the deficit, and we really want to draw the nation's attention to the deficits and balance our books. And last time in 2011, all they succeeded in doing is adding to the cost of debt. This time around, they'll really add to the cost of debt. So it makes a mockery of this idea that they care about our deficits. I mean, it's just the worst kind of ignorant economic illiteracy that's breathtaking.
For which there's no excuse. And I think the president has said that he wasn't going to negotiate with them about Obamacare, and he's willing to have some sort of grand bargain regarding deficit reduction, but holding the economy of the United States and the world hostage to their silly behavior is no way to get it done.
Well, William Cohen, I thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, Ian. Thank you for having me.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with William Cohen, the author of Money and Power, How Goldman Sachs Came to Rule the World. He's a contributing editor at Vanity Fair and writes for the New York Times, where he covers a variety of financial issues. His acclaimed book, House of Cards, The Tale of Hubris and Wretched Excess on Wall Street, details the last days of Bear Stearns and Company, and he began his career as an investigative reporter in Raleigh, North Carolina, and then went on to work on Wall Street for over a decade and a half, both at Lazard Frere and at J.P. Morgan Chase. And in 2007, he published The Last Tycoons, The Secret History of Lazard Frere and Company. We're going to take a brief station break. We'll be back talking about the passing of the 12th year mark of the U.S. and NATO war in Afghanistan.
Money makes the world go around, the world go around, the world go around. Money makes the world go around, it makes the world go round. A mark, a yen, a buck or a pound, a mark, a yen, a buck or a pound is all that makes the world go around. That clinking, clanking sound can make the world go round. Money, 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 money.
ಒಂದು ಚಶ್ಮಾನ ಮಸ್ತೆಸಿಯತ್ಮ ಬಂದ್ ನೋಜನಿ ನೋಜ್ದಾರಿ ಬಮೋಯೆ ಕಮಂದ್ ಅಜವಲ್ ಜಲ್ವಾಮೇಕುನಿ ಸದ ಹಜಾರ್ ಪಸ್ಬೆಗೋ ಜಲ್ವಾಯ ಫೆರೋಶಿ ಬಚಂದ್.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Matthew Ho, a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and the former director of the Afghanistan Study Group. A former Marine and State Department official, he resigned in protest from his post in Afghanistan over U.S. strategic policy and goals in Afghanistan. Previously, he served in Iraq, first with the State Department reconstruction and governance teams, and then in 2006 as a Marine Corps company commander. He worked on Afghanistan and Iraq policy and operations issues at the Pentagon and State Departments from 2002 to 2008, and in 2010, Matthew was named the Ridenour Prize recipient for truth-telling. He is a member of the board of directors of the Council for a Livable World and is the executive director of the Project High Hopes Veteran Speech Therapy Program. Welcome to Background Briefing, Matthew Ho.
Hi, Ian. Thank you for having me on.
And we're passing the 12th year mark of the U.S. and NATO war in Afghanistan. And, of course, this is a broken country, and we're talking about at a time when our government is broken. But just today on the BBC, President Karzai blamed NATO for not securing his nation and for bringing great suffering. And the partial list of candidates running in the next election to replace Karzai include Karzai's own brother, a pedophile, a warlord, and the mentor of the 9/11 mastermind. They're all running to succeed Karzai. So what does this say about Afghanistan's future?
It's not good, Ian. You know, I mean, I don't think anyone needs to be an international relations expert or a military veteran or a speaker of Pashto or Dari to know that this has been a failed endeavor in Afghanistan by the United States. The list of people who are vying to take over for Karzai, Karzai himself is the top of a completely corrupt patronage network that serves as the Afghan government. Nobody disagrees with it. It's quite evident. There's plenty of evidence to that effect. And, you know, and additionally, it's a government that's illegitimate. I was there in 2009 during the elections, during the presidential elections, and Karzai stole the elections, very clear. So we have failed to, one, bring an end to the conflict. This is a war that was going on in Afghanistan long before we arrived. We basically entered into the midst of a civil war. Saying we've failed to bring the war to an end. We have failed to bring democracy to Afghanistan because, again, what you have now is you have a sham. It's a kleptocracy, the very definition of a kleptocracy. In addition, we haven't done anything to better the lives of the Afghan people. The numbers that are presented by the U.S. government are patently false. The number of schools built, the number of hospitals built, they may exist on paper or in somebody's spreadsheet, but the reality is life has not gotten better for most Afghans, except for the corrupt few that we have put in power who have embezzled most of the money that we have spent in Afghanistan trying to make life better for the Afghans. So it really is. It's really quite a disaster. I think if you were to write a novel about this or to write a screenplay, it would be thrown back at you and saying this is too over the top. But that's the reality of it.
But Matthew Ho, when Karzai is confronted with these facts about corruption, he always says, well, the people where most of the money was stolen were in these contracts, all of which and the money didn't really leave the United States or in these NATO countries. So he really is accusing of not so much of trickle-down corruption in his country. He's saying that most of the theft happened within the contracting system itself. Is there anything to that?
Oh, sure. There's plenty of theft. Look, the corruption in Afghanistan is so vast that no one person or no one entity is responsible for all of it. It is vast. But just one example of the corruption in his government, one of his vice presidents several years ago, I believe it was 2010 maybe, but arrived in Dubai with $55 million in cash. We know this because of WikiLeaks. This is one of the things that WikiLeaks has shed light on for us. But yes, we see that where his vice president, Masoud, shows up in Dubai with just right. Crates of cash, basically. and that's throughout. I mean,
sure.
All this. Yeah, I mean, I had, when I was there in 2009, I had two different Afghans tell me this. Neither of these guys knew each other. One was in the east, one was in the south. But they both said, you know, this is what we call the golden age, because it is the time to get the gold. And literally just fire hoses. I mean, and also, too, and you have to look at it in the sense of how much money was in the country beforehand and how much money were we pumping into the country. I mean, this is a country that we at the height of our involvement there, we were spending $120 billion a year. And the country had a GDP of $12 or $14 billion. We have done nothing to build up the economy. It's not the only sustainable industry in Afghanistan. The only thing that has a value chain, you know, from start to finish, is the drug industry. Other than that, there is no industry. According to the U.S. Senate, about 95% of Afghanistan's legal GDP comes from foreign assistance. So when we pull out and we take all our money with us, there is nothing there. It will collapse.
Again, I'm speaking with Matthew Ho, senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and the former director of the Afghanistan Study Group, a former Marine and State Department official. He resigned in protest from his post in Afghanistan over U.S. strategic policy and goals in Afghanistan, and previously served in Iraq first with the State Department's reconstruction and governance teams, and then in 2006 as a Marine Corps company commander. He worked on Afghanistan and Iraq policy and operations during the Pentagon issues at the Pentagon and State Department from 2002 to 2008. Now, So this really brings to my mind the real question about the responsibility on our side, particularly people like General Petraeus. I mean, General Petraeus essentially saved George W. Bush's bacon by coming up with this surge, whether it was real or not. And obviously events in Iraq today certainly aren't pretty, so it doesn't look like anybody could call it a success. But Bush got himself into this pickle. He didn't know how to get out of it. He was in denial about how bad it was, and this very political general came up with a way to get out and essentially saved Bush's reputation, got his fourth star. Then he rolls Obama and says, you know, we've got to have another surge, just like this brilliant surge we had in Iraq. And it was a complete waste of lives, treasure. Mm-hmm. Is anybody holding these guys to account for what they've done?
No, there's no one being held for account. And in fact, they're lionized, they're promoted. When they retire, they get multiple jobs on boards of directors. They get honorary professorships or adjunct professorships at our nation's universities. And they're treated as some type of, they're almost like they're almost clerical, the way they're being treated, as if they are almost as if some type of religious order.
Or a kind of viceroy in the British colonial age, kind of thing.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes, and it's true. I mean, in my statement on the American military is, look, the history of the American military since World War II has been, and this is what dumbfounds me, and remember, I'm a veteran of 10 years in the Marine Corps, what dumbfounds me is that the American military has the highest approval rating among American citizens of all our institutions in the country, yet it hasn't won a war since World War II. And about the only thing it proves itself good at is getting in and winning in the initial stages, winning in the very beginning of the war, but then finding itself in a quagmire, in a stalemate, and the only thing it's able to do is basically set conditions to retreat. And I think that's what Petraeus did so well in Iraq, or I guess he did two things. Well, one, he got his name out there. He was able to get his photo on the cover of Newsweek or Time. He could go to the Super Bowl and flip the coin, you know, and start the Super Bowl, and everyone would love him. And when he told people that it was working, they believed him. And so the Americans were able to leave Iraq with this pretense that we had done well, that we had things were bad, but then we pulled together. Petraeus went there with 20,000 more troops, and everything got into shape. Same thing was what the plan was for Afghanistan, was that we're going to surge military in Afghanistan, we're going to win this, and we'll be able to pull our troops back with our heads held high. And that is certainly not the case. I am afraid that because we've been able to keep American casualties low this past year, that what will be said about the Afghan war is that we send troops there, extra troops there, it made things somewhat better, and then we pulled out, and then the Afghans ruined it. The Afghans blew it. Once we turned over the Afghans, it all went to hell. You know, same with Iraq. Once everything was great in Iraq until we turned it over to the Iraqis. You know, and that's just not the case. Our escalation of the war in Afghanistan has made things worse. It has made the country more fractured. It's increased the strength of the insurgency. And when we leave, because we have not done the necessary political things to bring about negotiations, because we were so adamant that we were going to win militarily that we refused to negotiate, well, when we leave now, we're going to pull those troops out, we're going to pull all that money out, and it's going to be a vacuum, and things are going to be very, very bad in Afghanistan, just as in Iraq now, where we pulled our troops out and things became very, very bad, because we just wanted to make sure that we left looking like we were winners, or we left looking like things were going well while we were still there, which was total farce.
But Matthew Ho, as somebody that served in Iraq and in Afghanistan, and I'm sure some of your comrades have been wounded. Many lose limbs, which seems to be the way of war from these IEDs, and many, of course, have died. To my mind, the idea that one of the candidates to replace Karzai as we leave for this new Afghanistan is the mentor of the 9/11 mastermind, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the guy that invited bin Laden into Afghanistan in the first place. And we know that the reason we went in there was because of 9/11 to go after him. To me, that's just breathtaking. I cannot believe that that's happening. That to me is the ultimate insult.
Exactly, Ian. And that's why I said earlier, if you wrote a novel about this, or you wrote a screenplay, no one would publish it. No one would make this film because no one would believe it. It's too over the top. But yes, it's true. You're absolutely right. Abdul Saif is the man who brought bin Laden into Afghanistan. And bin Laden went into an area that was not yet controlled by the Taliban. Several months after he got there, it became under their control, and he became basically their ward. But yes, and this is the man that a couple of years ago, Karzai wanted to lead the Afghan parliament. And now, this past summer, Karzai said, this is one of my preferred candidates. And now, he is a candidate as well, in his own right. He's teamed up, I believe, with Ismail Khan, who is from the west of Afghanistan, who is a very strict Islamist. And he is just as bad on women's rights and other issues as the Taliban were. So this notion somehow that we went in there to do the right thing is incredibly just wrong. And it is, and you're right, Ian. I mean, it is insulting. It's terrible to us that, you know, we went there after 9/11, and now 12 years later, the guy who brought bin Laden to Afghanistan may well be the next president of Afghanistan.
Well, Matthew Ho, thank you so much for joining us here today. I appreciate it.
Hey, thank you, Ian. You have a nice evening.
You too. Again, I've been speaking with Matthew Ho, who's a senior fellow at the Center for International Policy and a former director of the Afghanistan Study Group. A former Marine and State Department official, he resigned in protest from his post in Afghanistan over U.S. strategic policy and goals in Afghanistan, and previously served in Iraq, first with the State Department Reconstruction and Governance Team, and then in 2006 as a Marine Corps company commander. He worked on Afghanistan and Iraq policy and operations issues at the Pentagon and State Departments from 2002 to 2008. We're going to take a brief station break and be back talking about the $100 bill that's finally arrived. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Dr. Benjamin Mazota, who is a postdoctoral research fellow for inclusive growth at the Center for Emerging Market Enterprises at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He works on the cost of cash study, which shatters the myth that cash is free of cost, since virtually all economic actors pay direct and indirect financial burdens to participate in the cash payment system. Welcome to Background Briefing, Benjamin Mazota.
Thank you so much for having me.
So, Ben, I wanted to get an idea of the percentage of U.S. $100 bills that circulate abroad now that the new bill is finally coming out on Tuesday.
This might be the most international currency since Roman times. It's thought that two-thirds of the U.S. money supply circulates overseas, and overwhelmingly so in the large denomination, the $100 bill.
And why is that?
Well, it's really difficult to find a global currency that's accepted by everyone and that stores enough value in it that it's easy to make a payment for a business-to-business transaction or for a person-to-person remittance. It's difficult to find a currency that everyone sort of expects will be worth what it was worth when you first got your hands on it, that won't erode in value over time. It's probably the most stable currency in the world as far as that is concerned. And as you well know, in international financial markets, a lot of transactions are denominated in U.S. dollars, for example, commodity transactions. And the same turns out to be true for person-to-person markets and business-to-business markets. It's easy to make a transaction in U.S. dollars if the counterparties don't share a currency in common.
But my understanding is, Ben Mazzotta, is that it is also the most counterfeited. The $100 bill is the most counterfeited bill in the planet.
Well, it might be the best target in the world for counterfeiting for reasons we've just gone over. It's actually not the most counterfeited, the U.S. dollar, I should say. I don't know about the $100 bill in particular, but the U.S. dollar is not the most counterfeited currency on the planet. There's a report by the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis several years ago that suggests that the rate for the euro is around double what we see for U.S. counterfeit bills as far as the domestic circulation of bills. As far as what's circulating globally, I don't think there are accurate figures available on how many bad $100 bills are circulating worldwide.
Well, my understanding is, for example, before the Iranian Revolution, the Shah, who was basically, we were selling him anything and everything he wanted, he wanted to print some new currency to celebrate the Peacock Throne, and we sold him the intaglio presses and the cotton paper that prints the bills. And estimates are, after the revolution, that Hezbollah got hold of these, or the Iranians, revolutionaries, moved them to the Bakr Valley, the printing presses, and they printed about $17 billion in U.S. $100 bills. And this is based on the estimates based on the amount of paper they had. So that's a big chunk. A lot of these counterfeit bills, my understanding, the counterfeit $100 bills have shown up in Russia. Is that your understanding?
I'm certainly not well-versed in the appearance of U.S. $100 bills in Russia, but from time to time, there indeed have been governments that have been accused of complicity in the printing of counterfeit U.S. money, most notably North Korea in recent years for printing letter-perfect copies of U.S. $100 bills. The availability of intaglio presses is absolutely one of the primary security features in deterring counterfeit attempts, as is the limited supply of secure paper for printing knockoffs of U.S. currency.
So, Ben, the reason I'm calling you is I wanted to get an idea from you about the reasons for this long and inordinate delay of the new $100 bill that finally comes out on Tuesday. And there are many, many parts of this story, some of which read like a Hollywood movie. Apparently, one of the first shipments of the printed bills from the Bureau of Engraving to the U.S. Mint was intercepted by thieves. Billions were stolen. Is that right?
Yes, there's definitely been news coverage about an intercepted shipment of the currency. So that absolutely has the feel of a Hollywood caper to it, sort of the stuff that you just couldn't write.
So as a result of that, they had to change the bills, didn't they? They had to change the colors and stuff?
I'm not aware, I have to say, of the specific relationship between choices about the colors of the bills and that theft itself. I wasn't aware that that was the reasoning for changes that may have been made partway through, but it sounds like you've been following it very closely.
So, Ben, now that we're finally going to get the new $100 bills and we understand how much has been counterfeited over the years and the theft of the first batch, et cetera, but hasn't there been a problem, you know, with this latest batch, this coming out on Tuesday, with the printing? What do you know about the screw-ups at the Bureau of Engraving?
Roughly what I understand is about the same as what you can gather if you really poke around on the web and read the news reports about it. My understanding of the major printing problems have had to do with the way that the papers reacted to the increased weight of the intaglio presses, and that the first batch had an indeterminate number of bills that had folded during the printing process, and therefore they had gaps in where the ink appeared on the paper. They had little blank spots, and that the newest batch has had some blotching, so there's been some extra ink in places where it shouldn't have shown up, and certainly the government is not ready to put into circulation bills that are anything less than letter perfect. If they're not absolutely accurate, the government won't put them into circulation. It'll just continue to use orders of existing designs from all the appropriate suppliers dollars, because the last thing that you'd want to do is put into circulation a currency that's known to have sort of a production failure rate, because then all the counterfeiters would have to do is try to mimic somehow that they were some of the legitimate error rate in the production circulation. So as the bills are delivered from the Bureau of Engraving and Printing to the Fed, they're checked. And if the error rate exceeds whatever the tolerances are, then they refuse to accept the bills and they send them back. And those can turn out to be some very, very impressive numbers in terms of the value of the currency that's returned if, in fact, the Fed can't accept them. And the Bureau of Engraving and Printing is on record as saying that they don't get paid unless they deliver product that the Fed can use. So really, this is just the same as having accountants do work that turns out later not to have the sums add up, or you know, or having a car put together that the wheels fall off. If the currency isn't printed accurately, it can't be used, and whatever resources have been sunk into the printing of that money are essentially lost.
And I presumably the bad bills are destroyed.
Yes, the bad bills absolutely are destroyed. There's no sort of secondhand market for near perfect. You can't go to Kmart and get them at a discount.
So it's not like collecting stamps, where flawed stamps have enormous value.
No, there is some suggestion that the polymer bills that are being created in other countries around the world might be recyclable in a way that the secure paper that's used for U.S. currency is not. But I think we'll see whether or not that has a real impact on the environment and on the finances of those governments in a few years' time.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. Benjamin Mazzotta, who's a postdoctoral research fellow for inclusive growth at the Center for Emerging Market Enterprises at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He works on the cost of cash study, which shatters the myth that cash is free of cost, since virtually all economic actors pay direct and indirect financial burdens to participate in the cash payments system. And we've established that two-thirds of all $100 bills are circulated abroad, and we're talking about why it is that the new $100 bills have been delayed and delayed and delayed, and there are many reasons for it, some of which might well end up in a Hollywood movie. You mentioned, Ben, the polymer bills. Canadians have them. The Australians have had them for decades. My understanding is that they're harder to counterfeit. And talk about recycling. If you forget to put your money, take your money out of your pockets and wash your pants with Australian money, it's perfectly good. I mean, it comes out cleaner, but not damaged. Talk about money laundering.
I guess you could say that there, for the counterfeiters, there are ways of washing the dye off of U.S. currency in order to do some obscure step of a long counterfeit procedure that I certainly don't understand and wouldn't recommend that anybody experiment with at home. On the other hand, I can vouch as an American that I have put money through the laundry more than once, and I've never found it to be of noticeably substandard quality, but of course I don't sit on the other side of the ATM looking through the bills that I've that have come out of my wallet afterwards to know whether or not they get recirculated or sent on for destruction. The polymer bills do have a slightly longer life, and the first evidence from the Central Bank of Australia does, in fact, back this up, that the majority of notes that are passed, the vast majority of notes of counterfeit notes that are passed in Australia are indeed knockoffs of the pre-substrates, the pre-polymer bills, and not the current generation. So to the best of central bank research understanding, yes, it is more difficult to counterfeit the polymer bills, but they're certainly not immune. And you can find news stories on the web from the last couple of years from any number of countries that do have polymer or substrate currency, indicating that people are passing bad bills. And really, from the cashier's perspective, the trick is, how easy is it to tell that what's being passed to you is funny money? And so there's a number of tricks that are used by cashiers, not tricks, valid, reasonable tests to ensure that the currency is made of the correct paper, that it has the correct fibers in it, that it has all the modern security features that ought to be there.
So, Ben Mazzotta, why then does the Bureau of Engraving sort of stick to the old-fashioned methods if there are these new technological ways to make bills much more difficult to counterfeit? One of the excuses that I've heard is that the reason that they've, you know, stuck with the the paper and the green ink is that the American people weren't ready for brightly colored different notes. Like almost every other currency in the world had different colors for different denominations, but we stick with the greenback no matter what the denomination is. A little bit of color started to creep in. So is the Bureau of Engraving just basically a conservative operation?
You know, it's funny how many things about money really respond to sort of what your expectations are and what you're used to. And that's a lot of what our research at the Center for Emerging Market Enterprises covers. We try and estimate whether people are ready for change. The Central Bank of Australia has an entire study asking whether people learn from bank failures, whether they should switch over from keeping most of their money in the bank to some in a nice hard currency like the dollar or the euro, in addition to keeping some in the bank. And the evidence is that it's true, that people don't sort of gradually switch their behavior over time. They make these sudden changes. They learn in response to events. And then whatever patterns they have, they really like those patterns. So take the United States. You're self-employed. You're used to handling a lot of cash. It doesn't really seem out of place to you to have thousands and thousands of dollars in your house. You know, I don't want to speculate on the upper limits, but certainly, you know, more than $10,000 more than a comparable person who's not self-employed might just seem perfectly natural to you to keep in the house. A survivalist that keeps additional water and additional food in the basement might keep a ton of extra currency around just in case that blackout comes that makes it hard to get more money out of the bank or more money to send your payments to any old store where you might need to buy something or to pay your mortgage on time. So as far as what's the government's perspective on the color of money, I have to admit, as an American, when I saw that they were working purple into a $5 bill, I thought for the first time, it looked just kind of silly. And I don't think that that's a reason to make a national decision about anti-counterfeiting technology. But on the other hand, it's true that in other countries, we see all types of different substrate being developed and then used in currency design, different sizes of money to do everything from deter counterfeiting, but also to assist the visually impaired in identifying the denominations of bills that they're holding if their sight isn't up to 100%. So I think that all these choices are things that matter, and tradition is very important to the Bureau of Engraving and Printing. They've deliberately gone with their preferred supplier, their trusted supplier of secure paper that preserves the correct look and feel of U.S. currency. And in fact, some of the finest counterfeits that have ever been passed, one of the ways that they were detected ultimately was because a trained currency specialist kept crinkling that funny money in his hands and decided that they just had the wrong look and feel. So they kept looking and they found other microscopic evidence that in fact the bills had not been printed on official U.S. government secure paper. And this is big, big business, just like you've pointed out. There's lots of people that would love to have a cheap Intaglio printing press, and they cost tens of millions of dollars to get your hands on just one. One of the reasons is to prevent people who would seek to dilute the money supply and thereby steal the value of honest savers like you and me, basically erode the value of all of our savings accounts by passing funny money. It's exactly a deterrent. Try and limit to the greatest extent you possibly can the number of people that have ever seen or know how to operate an Intaglio press, the number of people that have any access whatever to official U.S. government secure paper.
So, Ben Mazzotta, let's turn in the last few minutes then to the work that you do on the cost of cash. Now, there have often been suggestions that we should do away with cash. Where do we stand on that?
The cash industry, it really is an industry, and there's very few buyers in the currency market, but everybody's curious what's the demand for cash. There are lots of different payment instruments, and often we talk about cash just as if it were a payment instrument, because in the United States, it's really not the primary saving asset for most households. It's uncommon that you get your salary paid in cash if you had what we'll term a job in the formal sector. Maybe that's a little bit too technical for some of your listeners, but I think we all know what it means to get paid under the table. People who are working day jobs under the table, maybe they're getting paid from their employers directly in cash, but the rest of us aren't. We're mostly using it for small value payments. And so that's really the payment segment where I think people least expect cash to be displaced anytime soon. There have been technical solutions to this problem definitely around for 20, 30 years. It's possible to get an e-wallet that will make peer-to-peer payment small value amounts of money that run on different payment rails than your MasterCard, than your salary payment, than your online bill payments. These e-cash systems are there, and they just seem not to have taken. The demand isn't there for them to displace the very smallest value transactions, but it's a moving target. So, for example, the Philadelphia Transit System, the SEPTA, is now thinking about accepting credit card payments in lieu of something that we call in Boston the Charlie Card. That's our contactless subway fare system. They're saying that you might actually just be able to whip out a credit card instead of a subway card to pay your subway fare as you walk through. And there's been some important technical developments in how the payments are processed that permit that. The currency specialists will tell you that cash's share of payments may be eroding somewhat, but that its overall demand in the United States and in most rich markets is, in fact, growing over time. The rate of growth is certainly in question. And the place where you see the very highest levels of cash use, places like the countries that we study in our reports, so that's India, that's Mexico, that's Egypt, the reasons that cash use is so high there is because of the types of payments that it's being used for. It sounds crazy to North American that you would go and pay every last bill for the month in cash, that if you owed the city some taxes, that if you wanted to pay your water bill, if you wanted to pay your mortgage, if you wanted to receive a salary payment, that those types of things would happen in cash. And yet there are an awful lot of those very large value payments from a retail perspective that are currently and traditionally made in cash in those economies. And so people need to keep a lot of cash on hand. These are also countries where not everybody has a bank account. In the United States, one of the things that our research shows is that people who don't have bank accounts pay a lot more for access to cash than people who do. It sounds funny. How can they need access to cash? Well, maybe their payments are coming as a paycheck or an electronic transfer, and they want to convert that into cash so they can go out and spend it. And those people who don't have bank accounts seem to pay the most, and they also pay the most often. They're the most likely ones to need to pay for access to cash when the payment instrument they get isn't the same as the payment instrument that they want to use later on. In India, for example, two-thirds of the population doesn't have a bank account. And of the people who have bank accounts, again, it's three-quarters of the bank accounts, roughly speaking, that are dormant, meaning that they haven't been used to make or receive a payment in the last year. So the vast majority of the population don't have bank accounts, and they're stuck doing everything in cash. So that's really where you'd see the most movement, the fastest, away from cash. And the poster child for that is Kenya. Kenya has seen rapid, rapid movement into mobile money in an economy where almost nobody had bank accounts.
Well, Dr. Benjamin Mazzotto, I thank you so much for joining us here. And I guess in closing, it doesn't look like the Bitcoin's going to take off, right? We're stuck with the greenback for a while, right?
Bitcoins are one of my favorite topics. Well, we'll have to spin another yarn about that some other time.
Okay. I appreciate you joining us.
Thanks again for all your attention and your interest in our research, and I wish you very well.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Dr. Benjamin Mazzotto, who's a postdoctoral research fellow for inclusive growth at the Center for Emerging Market Enterprises at the Fletcher School of Law and Diplomacy at Tufts University. He works on the cost of cash study, which shatters the myth that cash is free of cost, since virtually all economic actors pay direct and indirect financial burdens to participate in the cash payment system. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at ianmasters.com, where you can also contact me. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now. Love.
now.